grateful member of Al-Anon.
Thank you.
How's everybody doing?
Awesome.
Thank you very much for sharing your story. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come and share. What a great room. What a great conference you guys have here. Baskets are just amazing. I was like, oh my God, look at all this stuff. We just kept digging down in there. There's more things. Anyways, it's awesome. My heart's just pounding. That always happens when I get up to share, and I think that's God's way of helping me remain humble. Half hour?
Yeah.
I have half hour, okay. That's an interesting amount of time for me, because I either don't like to talk much or I like to go 45 minutes, you know, so I promise I'm not going to go, and y'all are hungry, so that'll be good. I'll maybe stay half hour. So just quickly, I was born and raised in outside a little farming town in Mississippi. I own a 500-acre cotton and soybean farm. I was not raised in active alcoholism. There was no drinking in my home. There was alcoholism in my family, which I discovered after I'd been in Al-Anon for a while and was working on a four-step. But basically, in my family, we lived really far out in the country. I'm 46 years old. We didn't have a telephone until I was like 10 years old in our community. And they paved our roads when I was like 12. I mean, we were really far out in the sticks, like Dukes of Hazzard. Actually, it was more like Beverly Hills Clampets, you know what I mean? Like, really far out there. We hunted. As much meat as we could, deer and stuff, as much as we could kill and put in the deep freezer, grow in our gardens, meant that we didn't have to go and buy as much. Well, we didn't have a lot of money. We had quite a bit of land, and that had a little bit of status with it. You know, not a lot, but enough that we weren't seen as like poor people. There was a lot of secrets in my family. My grandmother was the matriarch of our family, and she ran everything. We had a family farm. My father was, I don't think he ever like cut the emotional umbilical cord, because we lived right next door to them, and it was always about what Big Mama wanted. And she ran everything, and she was good at it. She was an untreated Al-Anon, man. She had like 10 plates spinning at one time, and she could keep them all going, figuratively. And so, I think she kind of saw me as kind of grooming me, you know, to teach me how to be a leader like her. And people really revered her. She owned a little country store, and a lot of people who were illiterate would come and have her fill out their papers and stuff. And good people. I come from very good people. They're just affected by the disease of alcoholism. And I can remember her telling me stories about how her stepfather that raised her was a drunk. And he would call ball games. He would umpire ball games. And he'd get so drunk that he couldn't call them well. And people would start making fun of him. And she'd put him through the fence and send him home. And then she'd fight the people that, you know, had been talking about him. And, hey, I relate to that. Because I love alcoholics, I understand. Anyways, my mom was quite passive, and when I was 7 years old, my parents divorced. And looking back, I think that three people in the marriage, my mom, my dad, my grandmother, was probably one people too many, you know. So she left, and my father got custody of us, I think probably because he had a lot of land and was able to provide well for us. Well, he remarried right away to a city girl. And I didn't realize, I learned a lot of this stuff about myself and my family after doing the steps and doing inventories and Al-Anon. My stepmother was an adult child of an alcoholic, but I didn't know it. And I think that she and I, unbeknownst to me, we were in competition for my father's love, because I was like the apple of his eye. I was the golden child. He wanted a boy firstborn. I was not, but he raised me like one. I learned how to drive a car when I was five. I learned how to chew tobacco about that time. Everything. I could shoot a gun, played softball, was just a golden child. I made great grades in school. I was a good softball player. I just did everything right. Part of that was because my stepmother was being abusive to me, and I wanted to get out of the home. And she would tell me that if I told anybody that she was being abusive, that it would be worse next time my father left. And there was no reason for me to think that she wasn't telling me the truth. So I learned how to stuff it. I learned how to keep secrets, and I learned how to compartmentalize. And I would come home, and I'd walk into the house, and I would take the emotional temperature of the room to see how I was supposed to act. What kind of mood are we in today? And I knew that as soon as I could get my chores up, I could get on my motorcycle and go to grab my shotgun and go, you know, squirrel hunt or whatever. And, you know, I think about that now, and it's funny. But that's where I found peace. That's where my higher power was, because in nature, I felt just scooped up, you know. I had a hard time with the God concept when I got into Al-Anon. But then through the years in program, I've looked back, and my higher power was always there. I just didn't recognize my higher power. I can remember when I was a little kid, I would go down to the squirrel hunt all the way down this little river, and the sun would be getting ready to set, and I love to tell this because I'm visual and I'm Southern and we tell stories. And so I would sit on these at the edge of these cypress trees at the river, and the ducks would be coming in like down towards the water, and the catfish would come up, pop their tails on the river, and the circles would go out, and the squirrels, I could hear them, and the birds would be chirping, and the sun would be going down, and it would be peaceful, and it would be beautiful, and I would feel okay for a minute before I had to go home and be scared to death, you know what I mean? So when I was 12 years old, I was seeing a little boy that my father didn't want me to see, and we had the family car, and a whole gang of us would go out because we could, you know, get the car, go out, and we'd go drinking and things that kids do. And in the country, all they can do is, like, play sports or hunt or fish or drink and have sex, you know. And so we would go out and drink and have sex. And and so that night when I was 12, I actually lost my virginity to this young boy that I wasn't supposed to be seeing, and I was afraid I was going to get in trouble. Or I didn't want my father to find out. But on the way home, my stepbrother, who was 2 years older than me, raped me. And I didn't know that what he did was worse than what I had done, because I could not discern which was the worst of those two things. So I kept another secret. And for the next 2 or 3 years, I'd go try to go to bed at night and go to sleep before my family did, because if I didn't, I'd lay awake till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, just petrified with fear that he would come into my room. And he didn't. But I want to tell you that I got really sick because I couldn't let anybody know what had happened. And so for 2 or 3 years, I had to manipulate and control situations that no one would know that I was trying to stay away from him. And they didn't know. Now, how sick are you got to get to that, you know, that you can't let people know this? And you're in my mind. I was always just busy, 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 because I had to act like everything was okay, but I couldn't get too close, because then I would be afraid. And it was just, in a way, fear for my life. So when I was 15 years old, that's why softball and things outside the home saved my life. Saved my life. So when I was 15, my stepmother made me go and do something with my stepbrother again, and it happened again. And this time I told. And my father made him leave. He wasn't living in the house with us at that point, but my father made him move away. And my stepmother just kind of turned up the gas, you know what I'm saying? She got really abusive then. I still couldn't tell about her being that way. And you know, the truth is, I think someone did try to tell. One of my relatives tried to tell my family what was happening with my stepmother, and you don't go in anybody's house and tell them how to raise their children. So they shut that down straight away. So at that point, I figured the best thing for me to do was just try to live to get through it till I could get out of there, but that was going to be my only hope. Well, my father told me I needed to get a scholarship to go to college because he couldn't pay for college. And so I was looking for a softball scholarship. And I like to say that I have a disease of perception. I wanted a softball scholarship because I was a little jock, and they didn't have very good softball scholarships, so I had to resort to a 4-year, full-ride, renewable, pay-for-everything scholarship. Now, how terrible was that, you know? I have a distorted perception, okay? The disease of alcoholism does strange things to at least an Al-Anon like me. My mind just doesn't work like everybody else's. And so part of that comes from probably thinking and feeling one way my whole life and everybody telling me I don't really feel that way. Many of you probably experienced that. Can't be mad, gotta be happy. And actually, a lot of the anger that I saw was so incredibly inappropriate, I was afraid to get angry because I didn't know what proper anger looked like. So I got a scholarship to go to Mississippi University for Women. Women's school. Now, I live so far out, I knew that something was different about the way that I was wired. I didn't know what it was, though. And so by the time I got to college, I had begun to figure out that there were people like me. And I found them. I sought them out very quickly. And I was out. We were out drinking one night and shooting pool, which is what you do when you go to college, right? And this girl, we had been having rush, and this girl who had an engagement ring had been very friendly with me, and I didn't really understand this, but I knew that I was out looking for a girlfriend. She sure was cute, but she was straight. I heard you should not mess with straight girls. And so I didn't, and I was really drunk, sitting up on a foosball table, and she started asking me all these questions. I like to tell this story because for alcoholics, I know that a lot of times I like to think that the alcoholic has a bigger ego than I do, but I'm just as sick as any alcoholic. The difference is I did not have to take alcohol into my body to get that sick, okay? Which probably makes me sicker. But so I have a lot of pride and a lot of ego, and I'm either feeling really, you know, my head is either this big or I'm less than you. So I'm sitting on that foosball table, and she's asking me if I have a boyfriend. I say, no. Do I date? She says, no. She says, do you have a girlfriend? I say, well, I look her square in the eye. I go, I don't know. Ask me in the morning. So we went to bed together that night. I was a little hot shot. I was all like 18 years old, right? And so we were together for the next 2 years. And it was the high highs and the low lows, you know. She was everything to me. It was all about how she felt about me. That's how I felt about myself. And, you know, it took me years in Al-Anon to even realize that she might possibly be a qualifier. I thought that when I got here in 1989 by becoming in a relationship with a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought that was my qualifier, but it had started way before that. Anyways, so I got in that relationship, and my tagline is, I was in the same relationship for 10 years, but the faces just kept getting different. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? Same thing, just different drama, different face, you know? And so so ultimately, when I was in my second relationship, I was a senior in college, and my stepmother, who had fallen ill with cancer, died. And 2 weeks prior to that, my grandmother, not Big Mama, but the other grandmother, died. I was getting ready to go to medical school, and something in my head just popped, and I thought, I can't do this. Because an Al-Anon like me, I certainly couldn't just do 4 years of regular med school. I'd have to be a brain surgeon, and that'd take forever, and I just couldn't do that right now. And so I'm not well. I'm better, but I'm not well. At this point, I was really sick. So my partner was going to move to Los Angeles to pursue an acting career. And so I said, well, why don't I just go with you? You know, my family thought I was just off my rocker. I had never been west of Dallas, Texas, and I come home and tell them I'm going to move to Los Angeles. And so they couldn't stop me. So I moved to L.A., freaking out in culture shock, okay? In Mississippi, we have one interstate. It runs from the north of the state all the way to the south, two lanes each side. I'm coming into San Bernardino in my little brown Pinto, and you know it's opened up to like six lanes on my side. I'm like freaking out. I'm like, oh my God, how do I drive? You know? It was crazy. It was crazy. And so get a job. I figure I could always go home if it got that bad. And so I got a job, I started working, and I come to a relationship with no communication skills. I don't have any tools. I don't know how to be in a relationship. I don't know how to be my own person. I have no spiritual life. I have nothing. And that soon, pretty quickly, that shows up because it's just me and my partner. And so I'd like to think I'm a person with ethics, and I saw this cute little girl at work that I wanted to have something to do with, and I was not going to be unfaithful to my partner, so I came home and promptly said, there's somebody I want to date, I'm breaking up with you, you need to move out now. And I thought that was like highly ethical and moral, you know? Bludgeoning people with the truth didn't mean a lot to me, you know? I've learned in program that we consider other people's feelings before we tell them the selfish thing that we're about to go do. So I got into a couple relationships after that, and at one point, I found myself in a relationship and in the bars. Okay, when I lived in Mississippi, we had to drive to Birmingham, Alabama at that time to find a gay bar. They just didn't exist down there. Talk about the KKK. I mean, it's just out backwards. And there was one point in Tupelo, Mississippi, where there was a bar, and it moved around because every time the cops would find out where it was, we would all get arrested. So, you know, they have to put it in different places. Birmingham was a big enough city that it was okay. So when I moved to L.A., I'm like a kid in a candy store. There's bars on every corner. They have a parade. They have a newspaper, for God's sakes. I mean, can you believe that? You know? Unbelievable. Well, I start going into bars, and it's like a kid in a candy store. You know, you put me in a bar, you know what there are in bars? Alcoholics. You know what? I'm an Al-Anon. You put me in a bar of 100, in a room of 100 people, if there's one alcoholic in the room, I am a heat-seeking missile. I will find you in 2 minutes, you know? It's like a homing mechanism. I know it's a gift. It's okay. I'm all right with it now. You know, it took me a long time to get okay with the fact that I love alcoholics. Generally today, I tend to fraternize more with sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, if I'm in a work situation sometimes, I'll find myself gravitating to someone who's very charismatic. And I'm like, God, you know what? I bet you that person. But anyways, I like to have fun today. So I'm with this person who drinks, and we're having fun, you know, doing the nightlife and everything. And, you know, I can deal with the drinking, but the cocaine that she's using, pretty quickly, you know, she's not showing up, and she has a two-year-old baby, and I've got to keep the baby. And I tell her, you've got to quit doing the cocaine. I don't care about the drinking, but you got to quit doing the cocaine, fully thinking that she would stop. Well, I didn't know anything about addiction or alcoholism or any of that, and she didn't stop, probably because she couldn't. However, being the dramatic Al-Anon that I am, pretending that I'm not, I did this big scene, and I moved out. And so then after that, I do what I don't know if there's many Al-Anons in the room or if you've ever done this. many of you alcoholics potentially could have done this, but I had to go and find out all the dirt that, all the lies, you know, that she probably had told me all this whole time because of you know, because certainly that had to be happening. And in the course of doing this, I saw one of her old girlfriends who had her current girlfriend with her who had 2 years sober in AA. Well, the girl was just kind of a bitch. She was all sullen and, you know, didn't talk. Now, and so I'm finding out stuff. And the next time I see this girl who was all sullen, don't you know, I fall in love with her, right? And so we have one date. Now we're married and we're going to be together forever. Because that's what I did. And Al-Anon like me, well, and a person as sick as I was, I had sex and tried to make a relationship out of it. Because I didn't know how to get to know you to see if then we could become more intimate and sex might work out of that. No, I put the cart before the horse because it's all that I knew to do. If we had lust and there was some chemistry there, I had to act on it immediately. You know, I mean, that's how it worked for me. I mean, because I didn't know not to. So we were in a relationship and I went to a lot of meetings of AA with her. And I loved going with her. I wanted to help her with her problem. If I could go with her, that'd be great, you know? And see, I thought she didn't drink anymore, that all my problems were solved. Drinking is but a symptom of alcoholism. You guys know that, right? Put the clog in the jug, but you still have the drunk, right? And so we pretty soon, because I didn't know how to communicate, I didn't know how to say no. She had a little problem with anger. So we got this interesting dynamic that started happening. And there's someone here in the front of the room tonight that was there. And right after I got into the room, my friend Jill came in, and she's been there. So she's got to keep me honest here. That's why you're here today. We got into some crazy situations. And the relationship became violent pretty quickly because my partner did not know how to contain her emotion. And I would do things. I was so addicted to her. I just was so enamored with her. I wanted all her attention. So when she wasn't giving me her attention, I'm such a sick Al-Anon, I would push the buttons that I know are there to get your attention. Because negative attention is better than no attention, because I'm dying on the inside. I don't know who I am, and I don't exist in and of myself. I think I need you to make me feel alive. So I'll do whatever I can to keep you engaged with me. Kick me out of a car at 30 miles an hour, it doesn't care. We're still dancing, you know. I mean, right? I mean, seriously, this is what happens. And this is in a sober household, okay? Now, this is really sad. We had another roommate that liked to try to kill herself sometimes, and I would come home, and, you know, we laugh, but there are sober households out there today where this kind of stuff is still happening. You know, and it doesn't have to happen because we have a solution. We have the steps. We have a way out. We can live in peace and serenity and in love with each other if we seek the solution. But I didn't know that there was a solution at that point. It didn't take very long for me to hit my bottom. I remember one time I got my eardrum busted and, like, tried to get her out of my car, wanted to go back to work, and she just hit the windshield and spiderwebbed the whole thing. And now, a healthy person would say, I'm out of here. Here's what I thought. I can help her. I'm not kidding you. That's what I thought. I can help her. That's how sick I was. So it didn't take very long until I was getting it. That was just completely insane. The drama was just out of control, but it was feeding me on some level because I didn't know how sick I was. And so about this time, I decided to go home. I was like 24, so we had been in that relationship for I don't know how long, maybe a few months. But I had been to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with her, and I had learned a lot about the steps. And I had this whole God thing and rigorous honesty and all this stuff. It's kind of seeping down into my consciousness. And when I was 12 years old, my father said, Carrie, there are three things that you can do that I will disown you over. Steal, love a black, or love a woman. Now, I like to joke and say that I wish I had stolen my first girlfriend that she had been black. It didn't work out that way. My first sponsor was black. I don't know if that counts. But so I went home. I was kind of afraid to tell him about my sexuality, but I couldn't handle living this double life anymore, you know. So in a very covert, not very courageous way, I kind of tossed it out there to my new stepmother right before I was leaving to go get on the plane. Like, what would Daddy do if maybe I was gay, you know? Well, what Daddy did was leave a 15-minute message on my answer machine saying, you're dead and buried as far as I'm concerned. You don't exist. I told the whole family, not to speak your name in my presence, and I don't want you contacting me until you decide you want to live another way. And this, coupled with the fact that I thought my partner was having an affair with our mutual best friend, was my bottom. There was a day at that time where you could look in my eyes and the lights were on, but nobody was home. And I knew that I was going to do something incredibly drastic with this precious gift of life that my higher power had given me if I didn't get some help. And the other roommate that we had been through a program, a treatment center, and I was able to go in for Al-Anonism, if you will. Codependency is really what it was, but same difference, same disease. And I went through 21 days of intensive treatment. And they essentially pulled out all my emotions and had me name the things that had happened to me to put the words to it. I had never been able to say, yes, that was rape. Yes, that was abuse. Yes, this happened, and own it and start to own it. They told me when it was time to leave, they said, you need to find a 12-step way of life. You better go. You better get plugged in because we can't help you anymore. You've got to go get those people to help you because you have to learn how to live. So I had gone to an Al-Anon meeting prior to that, I went into an Al-Anon meeting. I've been going to a lot of AA meetings. The AA meetings were outstanding. They drank coffee, they smoked, they cussed. It was like a bar, but with no alcohol, you know, and I loved it. And so when I went into an Al-Anon meeting, there were chairs in a circle, Kleenex boxes in the middle, everybody crying and talking about their feelings. I didn't want to be there. Did you want to be there? I didn't want to be there. And so I didn't go there until I had no other choice, you know. And so after I got out of treatment, I went to the meeting, and I had learned from listening in Alcoholics Anonymous to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and ask for a sponsor and get a service commitment and be of service. And so I went in and I asked for help, and I got a sponsor. And from the very big, thank goodness, my sponsor was so loving, because I was still in that relationship at that time. It took a few months for me to get out of it, and it was still insane during that time. And I began to learn about powerlessness. I could see unmanageability pretty well, you know. I mean, you know, wrists through windows, emergency rooms in the middle of the night, seemed a little unmanageable. Wasn't quite sure yet that I was completely powerless over that alcoholic. It took a little more insanity for that to happen. And then God, who was so gracious to me, had her move out to San Bernardino, and it made it a little bit harder for me to get to my drug, if you will. And so I made a lot of friends in Al-Anon at that time, and we had like a little brat pack. There were a bunch of us that were going through breakups at the same time, and we just started doing everything together. We were laughing earlier. We had answer machines in, remember those? And so we put music on our outgoing answer machines, and I would call Jill up, and I would say, call me, and get my answer machine. I put like Madonna's Love Doesn't Live Here Anymore on mine. You know? Just crazy stuff like that. But we had, you know, we were together with each other and trying to get better. And so I started working the steps with my sponsor. And step two, I got that I was powerless finally, and I was able to leave that relationship. And the whole higher power thing was really hard for me because I grew up in the South, and there's a very staunch, organized religion that I'd been brought up in that said there's only one definition of God, and this is it. And so I had a difficult time believing that I really could make my own definition of a higher power and that it loved me, because I had heard my whole life that with who I was, essentially at my core, I was going to burn in hell forever. And it takes a little time to unlearn things that you've been hearing your whole life like that. You guys know that. So, you know, my sponsor said I could use her higher power, and I did. I would get on my knees every night. Dear Stephanie's God, I would say my prayers, you know. She told me I could use her God, so I did, and it worked. She had something about her. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that it felt like this when I was around her. And it was peace, and it was love, and it was a presence, you know. And so I did what she told me, and I called her every day. And when it got time to do the third step, that was a hard one for me. But, you know, I did the third step to the best of my ability, and I believe that if I really abandon myself to God, that my life is no longer my own. I've been here long enough now to truly know that my life is no longer my own. If I just show up today and do what appears to be necessary to do, and only worry about right now, God will go before me and make all the crooked places straight. I mean, it just will all work out fine if I live in the day. I was so busy living in yesterday or worrying about tomorrow, I couldn't live in today. But I learned to do that here. You people taught me that. I did an inventory with my sponsor. We got together with a group of us and did a workbook. I've done inventories many different ways. And, you know, all I can tell you is just do it. You know, you're going to do more. Just do it. You got to get it up, get it out of you. It's the stuff that's making you sick. That's what you're holding on to, you know. And the first fifth step I did, my sponsor didn't go run screaming out of the room with her hair on fire, you know. And she didn't look at me any differently. And I watched, okay. I watched to make sure. And so, you know, it took time. for me to get through the steps, but I stayed involved. I remember being the literature person at our home group, and I had a job, you know, and I would do my job, and I would tell you about that. But, you know, thank goodness that we give people jobs, because sometimes it's what keeps us here. Because if I didn't have a commitment, sometimes I might not want to go, you know. And so when I got to step six, you know, and I was became entirely ready to have God remove all my defects of character. I don't think I was ready for all of them to be removed at first. But and some days I hold on to some of them still, I'm sure, you know. But what I've learned is that through time, I am ready to have them be removed. But sometimes I have to look and see what payoff I'm getting for some of them still. What is this serving me that I'm still doing this? You know, I don't always know, but God will show me. God will show me if I just look, listen, show up and listen. Humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings. You know, humbly, my sponsor that I have today, we talk about this word humility a lot. Humbly. I didn't know anything about humility, and I'm learning about humility the longer that I'm here. It's not, you know, I'm very arrogant. I can be very arrogant at times. And the spiritual life that I've learned to lead through the steps teaches me about humility. And if I have turned my will and my life over, then I no longer run the show. Maybe I can just sit down and shut up and not tell everybody every opinion I have anymore, you know? Okay, I try. And so, you know, I make a list of people that I harmed. I made a list. And my first eighth step, my sponsor had to help me with, because I put people on the list that I didn't owe an amends to, but I didn't know that I didn't owe them an amends. Because I had thought that some of the terrible situations I had been in, that I had done them harm. I'm not well, you know? And so she helped me look at that list and prioritize it and take people off that didn't belong there. And I learned that I need to make amends to myself by being good to myself. She told me when I left that relationship, that she asked me what my greatest fear was. Excuse me. And I said, my greatest fear is being alone. If I'm alone, I'll die. And I meant that. That's what I felt. She said, you'll probably have to walk through that fear in order to heal, in order to be better. And that scared me to death, but I did it. And I learned how to date, and I learned how to be in healthy relationships, and scared me to death. I developed this little 30-90 rule. I called my sponsor one day. This is kind of early on. And I said to her, I figured out a plan. And she just chuckled and said, okay, what is it? And so I said, well, if I find somebody I like, I'm not going to date him. I'm not going to kiss him for 30 days. And if I really like him, I'm not going to have sex for 90 days. And she must have been busting the gut to keep from laughing on that phone. She said, okay, honey, you just do that. And so, because I told you what I've been doing, having sex, making a relationship out of it right away, right? And so I kept finding that these girls that I would be attracted to, I would tell them my plan, and they didn't want to see me anymore. And I couldn't understand what was going on with that, you know? But eventually that changed, and I love that saying, water seeks its own level. As I began to change through working the steps, the people that I began to be attracted to were different. The people that I were attracted to when I first came here, I probably wouldn't even stop and talk to them today. Not because I don't like them or they're not nice people, but we're not vibrating at the same level anymore. I don't need that kind of sickness that I needed when I got here. And so in making my amends, I figured out that I owed my father an amends. But it took me a while to figure out what that was, because I was really mad at him. It took a while to get over the resentment. I had judged my father for judging me. So I wrote my father a letter, and I sent it to him, and it came back. Return to sender. And I told my sponsor, and she said, well, you did your part. You tried. Just keep going. Do your other amends. And I made amends to my mom. I had not been involved in her life very much, because it had been difficult for me to kind of live with the pain that I had been living with in my household and go see my mom, because she's so sweet, and I couldn't just open up and shut down. And so my amends to my mother was to have a relationship with her and to talk and to be open, and we have a fabulous relationship today. And I want to tell you that, let me just say, I continued and worked the rest of the steps, and life rolled on. I left Southern California, where I was for 11 years, moved to Boulder. They don't have gay Al-Anon in Boulder. I was a little freaked out by that, because here I hadn't gotten, you know, resolution with my father. So I've been in gay Al-Anon for like 11 years. And I was afraid to go into mainstream Al-Anon, because what if you didn't accept me? So I didn't have any choice, though. God got me alone. You know, I had to either go and share who I was or get sick and die. I was pretty sure those were my two options. And the people in Boulder, they didn't care. They don't care who you sleep with. They want to know, are you affected by alcoholism? That's our primary purpose, you know. And those people just hugged me up and loved me to pieces, and it healed a part of my heart. And I got a piece of me back. When I got ready to move to Phoenix, Arizona, to go and live with Lori, which is a whole other story that we don't have time to tell, honey. It's only 30 minutes. So I was getting ready to move to Phoenix, Arizona, and this man, who was a very, very dear friend of mine, he became like a brother to me. He was probably old enough to be, maybe not old enough to be my dad, but he is someone that I absolutely would not have mixed with. He's straight, probably conservative, Republican, church-going man, you know, that became a really good friend of mine in Al-Anon. He would call me at night sometimes, and he would say, I need to talk to somebody, and he would cry because he had the safety with me that he could allow himself to have that emotion with. And what a gift. What a gift. If I hadn't been here with you, I wouldn't have been able to be there to do that with him, you know. And I told him I was going to move to Phoenix, and he said, well, what are you going to do? I'm like, well, I'm loading my U-Haul. I'm going to drive down in a day, you know. And he said, why don't we load my motorcycle in the U-Haul, we pack your stuff around it, and I'll go with you. And I said, why? And he said, because I don't want you to go alone. And he drove with me to move down there. And there's the family. You know, God gives us what we need, you know. So I moved to Phoenix, Arizona, plugged back into Al-Anon down there. And at this time, thank God, the healing that I got in Boulder, I didn't care. I just went to mainstream and let's go. We're doing it, you know. And get right in the middle of everything. And because, I mean, I flourished in program now because I had the love, I had the acceptance, and I could just be who I was, you know. And I'm all about living the 12-step way of life because it's the only way I know to have a life. I was dead, you know. And so I'm living there with Lori. We're going and speaking and sponsoring people and doing workshops and just doing the deal because life is so full. For people who are new, if you get in the middle of this wagon and you stay on, you're right. You are in for the ride of your life. Life will be so awesome. Bad stuff happens too, but you know what? It'll be okay. There's so many people around you. You'll get through it. We learn to walk through life together here. I want to close by telling kind of what's happened with my father over the last few years. About probably 4 or 5 years ago, I was hiking in Phoenix one day, and I've been thinking about my dad, and I said, well, maybe I should, like, send birthday cards and Christmas cards, because whether he wants to interact with me or not, it doesn't mean I can't still be a good daughter. And it's more about me being the person that I want to be today because of the life that I'm living, because of the steps. I want to be a good person. I want to contribute. And it doesn't mean just in the rooms. It means at my job. It means, you know, with other people, the line at the bank. I can be nice. You know what I mean? Like, it's everywhere, right? We're supposed to be contributing members of society. And so I'm thinking maybe I'll give my dad a card. Come down off the mountain. And you guys know that song by Mike and the Mechanics called In the Living Years? Yes. It's a song about a man who has a fight with his father and he doesn't get to make up with him and his father dies. And he hears his father's voice in his baby's newborn tears. I mean, ooh, well, I hadn't heard that song. And like it always took me out because I would hear that and I would think about my dad. And I hadn't heard that song in a year or two. Come down off the mountain after thinking about that. And I turn on the radio and that flipping song is on the radio. I'm like, I get it. I will buy a card, okay? I learned to pay attention to these little nudges because if I don't, they become spiritual 2x4s pretty soon. You know what I'm saying? And so the next day I went to work. I hadn't bought the card yet. And I swear, as God is my witness, I turned on the radio at work and that song came on again. I put down everything at my desk and I went to Walgreens and I bought a card. So I started sending my dad cards. And I just sent them. I had no expectation. But I felt better having done it. Almost 2 years later, I went to the mailbox at my birthday and pulling out cards. And having been blessed to be able to go attend conferences and do stuff all over the United States, I got a lot of friends everywhere, you know what I mean? Because I'm just that kind of girl. And so, and I'll keep in touch with you. I will. I work, you know, I contribute, I participate in the friendships. So I'm pulling all this mail out and I look, and my mind, it doesn't calculate at first, and I see it's my father's handwriting. And I open up, and it's a birthday card from my dad, and he says, "Dearest Snookum," and that's what he called me when I was like a little kid. I'm like on the floor by now, you know what I'm saying? Because it just was like it meant so much to me. And so we kept sending cards back and forth, and one day that was good, and that was fine. I looked at Lori one day, and I said, "You know what? I think my higher power is telling me I need to go see my dad because he's getting old," and I would get reports from my family that his health wasn't good. And I never wanted to do this. I really did not. And she's like, well, go see your father. And I'm like, I don't know about that, you know. And so, because my relationship with all the remainder of my family is good. And I called him up one day, and that in and of itself was huge. I just talked to him on the phone. Excuse me. And I asked him if I could come visit him. He said yes. So I went to Mississippi to stay with the rest of my family, and I drove down 3 hours to where he lived. And I have to tell you that I have freedom today because of working the steps of this program. And I sat across from this man that had been my higher power, the man that I almost died over. And for once in my life, it didn't matter what he thought about me. I sat there and I felt good about who I was as a human being. And I felt loving, and I felt loving towards him. And I actually felt a little bit of sadness because he's so bound up in his stuff and his feelings that he can't express how he feels, you know? And we had a great breakfast, and we talked about football, which I love, Terre Haute, okay? I'm a big Colts fan, you know? I'm like dying over here, but anyways, a big football fan. And we talked about football, and we talked about life, and we didn't talk about anything controversial. We didn't talk about anything that I knew would make him uncomfortable. Because what was the point? What was the point, you know? And it really almost broke my heart because his health is really bad, and we got ready to leave, and he can't even pick his feet up off the floor. This is a man, when I was 15 years old, he could run faster backwards than I could forwards. So this was very challenging for me to take all this in and process it, but I didn't want to miss the miracle, so I just stayed present for every moment. And when we got outside, he hugged me, and we hugged. I'm a big hugger. And like, okay, I'm thinking it's time to release now, and he's still hugging me. And I, you know, when we stopped, he looked at me, and we were very close, and he said, "I really do love you." He said, "I know I don't show it very well, but I've never stopped loving you." And in that moment, I thought, "I believe you. I know that you do the best that you can, and this has just been about the disease of alcoholism," because he doesn't know how to feel. He doesn't know how to process and let go of resentment, you know? And it was okay. It was okay. This is a gift. I mean, I have a wonderful family, a 12-step family. Lori and I live with her mom, and that's a whole nother, you know, party going on. Her mom's 76, and like, you know, oh my God, it's just crazy in our house all the time. It's wonderful. We have program people in and out of our home all the time. We do things at our house, and if someone had told me 22 years ago that my life would look this way, I'd have laughed my butt off. I would not have thought it would be anything like this. And you know what? I wouldn't trade one moment of it. It's such a gift. It's so beautiful because I'm living my life today. I feel happiness. I feel love. I feel peace. I didn't know. When I got here, I was okay and fine. Those were the two feelings I thought I had, you know? And I feel a plethora of emotion today, and all of them are okay. And for the most part, the channel is open because it's been cleared by the steps and the traditions, and working the traditions in a relationship. I have a beautiful relationship with my partner. I said to her yesterday, "I think I love you more now than I did when I met you," you know, because I'm continuing to grow. I love me more, therefore, and I love my higher power more. I'm able to love you all more, too. And there's no reason for me to think that I can't continue to be rocketed into the fourth dimension if I show up, work on today, and let God take care of all the tomorrows. I'm so thankful to be here with you today. Thanks for letting me share.